This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hi, I'm here with Professor James Dunlop from the Royal Observatory in Edinburgh. Hi.
Hello.
And welcome to the Jodcast. So you just gave a talk for our department. Could you start off by giving us a brief overview of what your research interests are?
Sure. So I guess I'm interested in cosmological evolution. Once upon a time, mainly of black holes and AGN, but these days galaxies. So almost all of my research is focused these days on galaxy evolution, right from just after the Big Bang and the first galaxies formed to the present day.
And what are the kind of major questions you're trying to answer in that area, like galaxy evolution?
So there's basic questions like when and how did the first galaxies form? Why was there an era in the universe about 3 billion years after the Big Bang, which seemed to be the climatic era of galaxy formation, and what shut down that formation thereafter? Because most massive galaxies now are red and dead. And also things like, when was the dust produced in galaxies? And we're interested in the dust because the dust contains the elements of life, things like silicon, carbon, iron. All these elements that wouldn't have been there after the Big Bang were manufactured in the first generations of stars. Mm-hmm. So even if you're not interested in galaxy evolution per se, in a way you're tracing the history of the periodic table of elements. Mm-hmm. And so most people would be interested in that at some level, I think.
It's tracing it right back to its own.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things is we're now back about 95% of the age of the universe and we're still seeing galaxies, so we haven't got to the first galaxies and the first stars. And that in some ways is a surprise. So there's a relatively small window now where we know if you look a bit further back in time, there should be no galaxies. We're still not there yet. So as far as we've been able to look, we still find galaxies. Fewer of them in smaller galaxies, as you'd expect, but still we still have not seen the first stars and galaxies.
So you mentioned that there seems to have been a spike in galaxy formation and that most of the massive galaxies we see were created quite a long time ago.
Yes.
Are there any possible explanations for that?
Well, I think people understand why the biggest galaxies started forming earliest, because the way gravity works, the first galaxies to form, they would have been dwarf galaxies, but they would have been in over-dense regions of the universe, and then they would have merged. And to make today's most massive elliptical galaxies, they would have started forming early. Perhaps more of a mystery as to why they're not still forming stars. So it's not that they started forming early, it's the fact that they shut down some time about 10 billion years ago, and somehow, despite being at the centre of big gravitational potential wells, where you'd think they could suck in more gas, they stopped forming stars. At some level they said, right, we're done, we've had enough, we're already big galaxies and we won't bother making any more stars. So that's one mystery that's still not properly understood. There are lots of ideas, but it's the shutdown rather than the early start that's the problem for these objects.
So it's those red and dead galaxies, they typically are found in like galaxy clusters and things like that?
Yeah, and again, that's what you'd expect. The rich areas where you maybe had a slight over-density in the early universe, that would be the progenitor of today's most dense, spectacularly dense regions. So they would be the clusters. And it may be there is something about the cluster environment that helps heat up the gas that stops that falling in to form more stars. That's certainly one avenue that people are looking at.
So you mentioned that you originally started off studying black holes and AGN, and you've now kind of moved more to focus onto galaxies.
Yeah.
What's prompted that move?
Practicalities, I suppose. I'm old enough now to remember that high-redshift objects used to mean quasars and radio galaxies. If you go back, I suppose, just over 20 years, then any galaxy known over what we say is a redshift of 1, which means looking back in time to the first half of the universe's history, they were all radio galaxies or quasars that had been discovered through the emission produced by their black holes. And that was simply because we didn't have sensitive enough instruments to see normal starlight from normal galaxies at that era. And then in 1996, two things happened around that same time. One was that the Hubble Space Telescope got fixed after its initial fiasco with its bogus optics. And people started doing deep imaging in the optical, which is rest frame ultraviolet, and seeing galaxies out to redshifts of 2 or 3. So starting to see about 10 billion years back in time. And then at the same time, people knew a lot of star formation was obscured by dust, but it's really hard making sensitive telescopes to see what is relatively cool emission from warm dust. So this is looking at objects emitting at a few tens of Kelvin. And obviously you have to cool down the detectors, and that's a lot colder than the environment. And so about that same time, there was a telescope called the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope, still working in Hawaii, which got fitted with the first detector sensitive enough to see dust-obscured star formation from high redshift galaxies. So within a few years, there's papers about 1996, 97, 98, where all the first detections of optically detected galaxies are coming from Hubble, and all the first detections of dust-obscured galaxies in the higher edge of the universe are coming from SCUBA and the James Clerk Maxwell telescope. And so this is a nice time to be talking about this again, because it's almost the 20th anniversary of what was really primarily a technological revolution, both in the optical and in the millimetre.
Today you talked a little bit about your recent work with ALMA, looking at the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
So it's a kind of coming of age for millimetre, submillimetre astronomy. So I mentioned before SCUBA and the James Clerk Maxwell telescope, but it's still doing good work, but it's a single dish telescope. It's a big dish, it's 15 metres diameter. But just the physics of light means that if you're looking at long wavelengths, sort of microwaves, you can't make a very sharp image if you've a single telescope of only 15 metre diameter. You have to get an array of telescopes. And that's been doable at radio wavelengths for a long time, but ALMA is the first really effective big array that can image in millimetre wavelengths. With the Hubble Space Telescope, you've been able to make really sharp, high-quality images, the things that people are used to seeing all the posters from. But it used to be if you looked at a millimetre image of the universe, it looked really rubbish, or kind of blobs of indiscrete emission in the sky. And essentially, it is a heat map, but you needed the Atacama Large Millimetre Array, this ALMA telescope, to make images of the same quality at millimetre wavelengths to match what Hubble can see in the optical. And so this is the dawn of a new era where we're not comparing really sharp, pristine images with Hubble with big, vague blobs in the millimetre. Finally, you can make an image at rather similar resolutions and ask, you know, in the same field, this deep field that we talked about today, the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, how much dust-obscured star formation is there overall cosmic history in that patch of sky, and how much UV-visible star formation is there in the same patch of sky, and in a simple-minded way, add it up and just see as a function of time looking back how much star formation there is at each epoch. Basically, the dust absorbs a lot of the UV light from young stars, because stars form in dense clouds, but energy conservation means it must come out again. It comes out in the far infrared, which gets redshifted to the millimetre. So instead of now trying to correct for what we might be missing, you just look at the two complementary wavelengths and you complete the census of star formation. So it's almost like the technology is now sufficiently advanced that you can do what you would always have wanted to do in a simple-minded way and just add up the obscured star formation and the unobscured star formation and complete the census.
Without having to make lots of assumptions.
Without having to kind of correct and guess for what you might be missing, you just simply say, right, I know I'm missing a lot of in the UV, so let's just look at the wavelength where it's got to come back out, and you get a nice complete picture.
Can you also learn something more by comparing what you see in the UV and what you see from the obscured emission?
One of the messages of today's talk was that the high-mass galaxies, which basically also form the most stars, really struggle to get any more of that light out in the UV. There's something about being a high-mass galaxy that means you're very dusty. Or there's something about star formation that once you get beyond a certain intensity of star formation, somehow no more UV light can get out and almost all of the light gets reprocessed. So whereas if you go to very low-mass galaxies, if you look at the UV light, you might have to correct it by a factor of 2 to make up for what you're missing. For the high-mass galaxies, basically, the UV is almost irrelevant, or you'd have to correct it in some huge extrapolation by a factor of 200 or so. So that maybe tells us something about chemical evolution, that the high-mass galaxies have already been through a lot of cycles of star formation and the interstellar medium is already enriched in metals and dust. Or it just may be something about the life cycle of star formation, that to see in the UV, you basically need relatively clean sight lines into the galaxy. And maybe once you've a galaxy full of molecular clouds all forming stars, there's almost no sight lines left and it all comes out in the reprocessed form. It's a bit like cosmology, where we know in cosmology how much dark matter there is, how much dark energy is, but we don't know why. In galaxy evolution, we're now getting a fairly complete set of patterns. We know how star formation depends on stellar mass of the galaxy. We know how much is obscured and how much is unobscured, and there's clear trends there. But the astrophysics of understanding why these trends are so clear is not understood yet.
I don't know if this is an impossible question, but do you know how you can get at those astrophysical questions?
Well, simulations have moved on a lot as well. And one of the weaknesses of simulations often is that simulations have been quite successful in predicting a lot about galaxies nowadays, but often when they try to work out how to put the dust into the simulations, they just kind of throw some in according to some simple recipe. So now we're getting a much clearer picture of how the dust properties of galaxies depend on stellar mass, for example, and on epoch redshift. People will be able to try putting in one prescription for dust, and then we already know that some of the simulations using certain prescriptions are just miles out in this. And so you can have a simulation that you think is right in a pure sense if there was no dust in the universe, and then you can try now putting in different recipes for how the dust is made and distributed around the galaxies and see which one of these recipes works closest to reality. And having got that recipe right, then you can ask the question, does the simulation match reality? So I think before the simulators have been able to get away with, and now we throw dust into all our galaxies and make them a bit obscured, and now that's not going to work anymore. They actually have to produce the trends with things like stellar mass and star formation rate and explain why the trends are so clear, because they're quite unambiguous now.
So it could be quite an exciting time for simulations.
No, I think that's right. And also, you know, people have to explain why the dust seems to form quite efficiently. You know, high rate of galaxies, people used to think it was quite hard to form dust, but it seems easy to form dust in high mass galaxies. Mm-hmm. And so that needs to be understood as well.
So you mentioned that you're hoping to get more time on ALMA to do an even deeper image, is that right? So what are you hoping that you'll learn from that?
Well, we know that there's lots of sources that we could have detected if our image was just a few times deeper. And we know that because if you stack on the positions of known sources from the Hubble optical imaging, individually they can't be detected. So, you know, as I was saying today, we basically detect about 20 sources. But then there's thousands of galaxies in the Hubble alternate field known from the Hubble imaging. And if you stack on the fainter sources, you can see on average that they are detected in the millimetre of the ALMA image. So they do have dusty star formation. And not only that, you can estimate how bright they are. So we already know if we could just get a few times deeper that instead of just 20 sources, we'd have 100 sources. And so we'd like to, stacks are all very well, but they tell you average properties rather than source by source properties. And so it's just it sounds extravagant to go from 20 hours to 120 hours, but there's lots of telescopes, more mature telescopes than ALMA, that give out thousands of hours of time to large projects. So this is what ALMA needs to do as it matures as a facility. It needs to give not to lots of programs, but a few programs need a few hundred hours to do what only ALMA can do and make an impact in this field. ALMA is the only telescope that has any chance of seeing the dust obscured star formation from these objects. And so we'd like to do that. And then going beyond that, you could argue that it would be a bit of a law of diminishing returns, because as we get to very low mass galaxies, then the evidence is they're not very dusty. So I think there's a place for ALMA to push a bit deeper and finish the job of connecting the obscured and the unobscured universes. And then it'll be time to do something different with ALMA, which is probably exploit its other great power, which is very high resolution imaging. And so that by then, if we'd 100 sources detected in the alternate field, rather than just keeping on doing the population census, we would then individually pick them off at much higher resolution and see the structure of the dust in these objects. And so that would be the beginning of a new era where ALMA will study these galaxies in detail, having itself done the job of uncovering the things in the first place for study.
And would you be looking to answer different questions once you were like taking it on a galaxy by galaxy basis?
Because we have this very high quality resolution in the RESFRAME ultraviolet from Hubble already. So then you really could push ALMA to match the very high resolution in Hubble and ask things like, is the UV coming out of the same patches of the galaxies as where the dust obscured star formation, or are they completely complementary? Where we see the UV, is that where we don't see the dust obscured star formation? Because it could be either way. There could be star forming regions where we get a bit of UV and a bit of far infrared, or it could simply be that the two things are exact opposites. It's known that the UV star formation is very clumpy in these objects. We don't know really whether that's because the star formation is very clumpy, or whether these windows into the galaxy that the UV comes out is very narrow, very narrow sight lines. So we need to remove that bias. And so if you end up getting just as clumpy star formation in the ALMA images, then that will be interesting. Equally, if the ALMA imaging is much smoother, then we'll have been seen to get a very biased view of star formation in these galaxies from the Hubble imaging, because it will simply have been those lucky sight lines that we happen to see a bit deeper into the galaxy, and it won't have so much physical meaning.
Okay, so it'll help you to interpret those Hubble images.
Yeah, and that'll be important for the simulators, because at the moment the simulators are working hard to make these clumps, but if these clumps are an artificial artifact of the biased Hubble view of these objects, then that's a complete red herring.
And it's always hard to know as a simulator whether or not the things you're getting are real.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a favourite moan of simulators that the observers have to get the answer right, but, you know, it's a two-way street. As the observers push things on, comes a point where the simulators can't legitimately ignore the observations anymore.
Yeah.
And it needs to be remembered, even your favourite simulator would admit that this is an observation of a lead field. None of the simulations predicted these heavily dust-obscured star-forming galaxies that you see in the sub-millimetre surveys. They were completely absent. People didn't think you would get objects forming hundreds or thousands of solar masses per year. Or if they did, they actually predicted that they would be incredibly UV luminous. They somehow failed to realise, understandably, that these things would already have had previous cycles of stars sufficient to enrich the interstellar medium and mean it was already metal-rich and therefore dusty. You know, their picture of a massive star-forming galaxy was a pristine hydrogen-helium object at very high redshift, quite extended pancake structure, forming thousands of solar masses per year, but all visible in the UV and Lyman alpha, not what the universe is actually like.
It sounds like if you were trying to make those predictions, some simulations, you would need kind of a scale and resolution simulation that we don't really have at the moment. Is that right?
Well, there are multi-scale simulations. A lot of the challenge of the simulators now is to... There's certainly good simulations at the individual kind of Milky Way level. Although if you give them, you know, the same starting conditions, so the same dark matter halo mass that we know the Milky Way has, different simulators produce very different versions of the Milky Way, depending on what recipes for the complexities of feedback from star forming. One of the main changes in the field over the last 5 years, I would say, is that people now realise that star formation is quite inefficient. Most of the gas that falls into a galaxy heads back out of the galaxy.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
About only, I don't know, about 20% of the gas that falls into a galaxy forms into stars. Most of the rest is either bounced out by the supernova explosions and the energy inject, the winds and things, or reprocessed and then re-ejected in heavily processed form in the form of supernova remnants. And so you get very different looking galaxies from the simulations depending on how much you turn up the feedback knob, if you like. And in fact, that explains a bunch of mysteries, like why are there so many metals in intergalactic medium in between the galaxies is already known to be quite metal rich, and that's because a lot of that gas has been in galaxies and come back out.
It's just recycled through.
Yeah. So this whole cycle needs to be properly understood, and it's sort of thought that in low mass galaxies, which don't have big potential wells, they struggle to form stars because they make some stars and then they go bang, supernova, and lots of energy is injected, and that throws out most of the gas that's there to form the next generation of stars. And then at the other end of the mass spectrum, the big galaxies seem to have these supermassive black holes in the middle which provide their own kind of energy feedback through quasar activity. And so it seems that at low masses and at high masses, star formation is suppressed. And it's actually intermediate masses, coincidentally or otherwise, where the Milky Way is, that star formation is most efficient. And so our Milky Way is in this kind of sweet spot of kind of 100 billion solar masses of stars, where obviously the feedback's still there, but the gravitational pull is big enough to make decent-sized galaxies, where a fair amount of the gas is turned into stars. So understanding all of that is part of the campaign, because people understand what the mass function of the dark matter should look like, and the galaxy mass function doesn't look like that. It's got less at low mass and less at high mass, and then a kind of knee where galaxies seem to be at kind of at a sweet spot of doing a good job of forming stars, and that's where the Milky Way is.
Oh, I didn't realise that. Well, thank you for that.
Okay.
Very interesting. And hopefully we'll have you on again in the future.
Okay.